Hello and welcome to the Upstate Carolina Linux User Group Podcast.
Thank you, Lynn, for that introduction. Welcome to the Upstate Carolina Linux Users Group in South Carolina. Here we are at Medion. My name is Jace. I will be doing the first presentation on shell scripting for newbies. This is our last shell scripting for newbies. Yay! Okay. I'll just go ahead and get started. I've got a handout, which was your assignment to pass everybody a handout if they want it, that has all the scripts for tonight. So last month, if you remember, if you were here or have heard it on the podcast or whatever, I discussed the for looping construct in shell script, bash specifically. That is what's called a compound statement within bash. It's one of many. You've got for, you've got if, which I had discussed several months ago. Tonight I'm going to discuss while, the while construct, the case construct, and the select construct. I'm calling them constructs. I don't know if they're whatever. The compound statements. So tonight we're going to do while. I'm going to print out. I did a simple spinner call, and I called the program while spinner. So you see here at the very beginning, you've got the shebang min bash, indicating that bash is going to interpret the program. And then I've got the next four lines is spinner, square bracket 0, 1, 2, and 3. And I'm assigning them a different character. In bash, you have arrays. So you can have a variable that not only just holds a value, it can also have an array of variables. And they have their own subscripts, the subscripts being in square brackets. So you see right here, I've got the first spinner 0 to the dash, spinner 1 to the forward slash, spinner 2 set to a vertical line, and spinner 3 set to a backslash. Now I had to quote both the vertical line and the backslash. Does anyone need to discuss why that is? It's because they're special characters. Right. That's right. Very good. the vertical line is, as you know, you pipe the standard out of the left side to the standard in of the right side. So we had to quote it. And the backslash is a special character that escapes characters. It's a quoting of the next character. And so I'm going to quote it. I'm going to quote the backslash. I'm going to backslash the backslash. Just the backslash character. I could have also used single quotes, double quotes, something like that. But I'm just giving you the multiple ways. And I probably, good form would have said to do that with these other two, but this works. So. And then I've got just this variable called n, setting it to 0. Now I've got an echo dash n of a space. Yes, sir.
What's the dash n do on that?
The dash n gives no new line. So instead of doing, if I were to do it without the dash in, echo would just put a space and then a new line character, carriage term. So let me just run this little program right quick. And while spinner, you see here we got a little spinner. You've probably seen this in downloading and that sort of thing. It's just an animated little spinner. And it's, all it is it's just the minus sign, the forward slash, the vertical line, or pipe character, and backslash. And it's just going through them all. So here is while. The way while works is, like I said, it's a compound statement. You have while, I can some commands, a do, some more commands, none. And that is what, the while construct. Now, because this is on a different line, you have to have, if you're going to make, so there's the separator between the while commands and the do. So if you want to put it all in one line, you need to use a semicolon to do. And, well, anyway, that's not important. So anyway, so what it does is it tests this, or it finds out what the return value of this part is, and I'll say while command, so I'll just put in the word command here. So let's say command is some program that I've written, or it's a standard program. So whatever the return value, the exit code of command is, as long as this is true, then it will do the block, the do done block. It will do everything in here as long as command is true. Now, again, going back to what we've discussed in the past, the return value of command, in order for it to be true, it means that the return value is zero, meaning no error. If there was an error, usually by convention, commands return 127 or 15 or 16, and they mean their own thing. So, does that make sense to everybody? Newbies? As newbies at any time, those of you that are brand new and have not been here, this is a newbie session, so stop me at any time and we can talk about anything. All right? Just because I've discussed it in the last couple months doesn't mean you know about it. Or you've even heard the podcast. I'm famous.
So that can be any program, any command in your past date.
Sir?
You're saying that can be any command in your past date, right? Because it's going to look through your path and find your command.
It can be in your path, it can be in the path of the program. If you set a path to just that program, because your shell script is going to be run in its own environment. It's going to be forked off, run over here, that sort of thing. You can also put a full path up, you know, if you want to do something. Probably more often than not, you will use the test program, which I've discussed in the past. What test does is it looks at, you know, some sort of equality or, you know, if the file exists or that sort of thing. If you do a man page on test, you can see what all it does. So if you're going to use test, it would either be, instead of command, you'd have like test and then, you know, 5 is equal to, you know, x or something like that. So as long as x is equal to 5, in quotes, then test will return or have an exit code of 0, which is true. So that's true. That also, you know, in test in its other form, and probably what you'll more likely see is either the square brackets, which would probably be the test in either bin or user bin, or the double square brackets, which is the built-in test, which would be faster. But and the two tests have slightly different syntaxes. But more often than not, you'll see a while test. So when I say test, I mean square bracket, double square bracket, or the test program. So lumping all those together. But it doesn't have to be the test program. It can be any program. It can be any combination of programs. You can do a double ampersand to and short circuit and all that sort of thing. So is that clear, everybody? Make sense? Okay, cool. All right, so I got my spinner. I'm going to control C, and that's... So now let me show you what I've done here. I've got the spinner running, so you see what arrays are now. I'm putting a space, and I'll explain why later. Now, if I explain what why is true, as you remember from 2 months ago, is that the true program has a return value of 0, which just is true. The false program returns it's either 1 or -1, I think it's 1, which is correctly exiting false, right? It's kind of confusing, but the false program purposefully doesn't work right, right? Okay, because that's what you're expecting, false to be false. Okay, so now you see in here, in my do done loop, I've got setting n equal to dollar sign square bracket n plus one square bracket. The dollar sign square brackets is mathematical stuff within the bash shell. So I'm just setting n to n plus one. I'm just incrementing n. Then I'm setting n equals dollar sign paren n percent for paren. The dollar sign paren is the same as the dollar sign brackets. I don't know why. There's two forms of it. Probably one was inherited from the corn side, the other was inherited from the corn or seashell side or something. I don't really know. But these two are both mathematical stuff. This increments it by one. This does the modulus of four. So whenever I get a value of four, I'm going to increment it. I'm sorry, whenever n goes into the loop, it starts out at zero, and then I automatically increment it to one, so n is now one. Then it does one modulus four, which is one, and n is now one. Then the next statement is echo dash en, and the dash en, as we were talking about earlier, the n tells it not to put a carriage return, and the e is to, I don't know what it stands for, but it's for special
escape
characters. That's probably what it is. Escape characters, yes. So I've got a backslash b, which is a backspace character. So it's going to backspace, okay? So it's going to backspace, it's going to print, and I got dollar sign, brace, spinner, square bracket, dollar sign n, square bracket, brace. So n, now we know, is 1. So spinner sub 1 is forward slash, and that's what it prints. So it prints, at the very beginning, it prints the space without a new line. It backspaces over that space, which is why I had to put it at the beginning. Backspaces over that space, and then it prints forward slash. I commented out the sleeve because otherwise it's very slow, choppy sort of thing. And I just tried it one way or the other. So sleep will just sleep for 1 second. That's what sleep does. And then it comes back and goes back to the beginning and tests if the command part is true. True is going to return true, so it's going to go back. It's going to increment n by 1, make it n equal to 2. Modulus of 4 is 2. So spinner 2 is going to be a vertical line. That makes sense? Then it's going to go and do it for 3, backslash. Then it's going to go through 4. Now here's where modulus comes in. 4 modulus 4 is 0, right? And then we get spinner 0, which is the dash. Okay?
Why should you do the modulus instead of saying if n is greater than 3 and equals 0?
You could have done it that way. I felt like it.
You're overriding modulus, right?
I wanted to show what modulus was. Exactly. There's the man. Yes, I want to show what modulus was. But yeah, so it's just going to go 0 through 3. 0 through 3, 0 through 3, 0 through 3, blah, blah, blah. And since I've got no way of exiting, I had to control C to interrupt the program to kill it. Any questions on this program?
Yeah.
You can do sleep fractional values, can't you?
With the new sleep, you can, yes. If you use another sleep, I think by tradition it's always been whole seconds. I may be mistaken on that. And there's also a U sleep, which does microseconds.
Come on in, which is somewhere else. Hey, come on in. Is there a reason why you did pound new colon while? That's a comment, right?
Yeah, that was a comment to me to remind me to tell you this is new. Wild is new. Introducing new. Or wild. So you'll see that. Arrays are brand new this month. No, that's right. That's just for me. Okay, now we've got our wild menu program. So let me run it first so that everybody knows what I'm talking about. And here we go. All right, so it says, number one, check email. Number two, surf the web. Number three, edit file. Number four, spreadsheet. Number five, exit. So I'm going to say, I want to surf the web. Hey, it launched Firefox. Okay, now I want to check my email. Hey, it launched Mutt. Let's do number four. Hey, open office, all right, that's cool. Number three, open office again, hot dog. Number five, exit, great, fantastic. Okay. Pretty typical menu sort of thing. You want to give this the first time?
Users, no.
How do I edit a file?
Well, let's put it in open office. All right, so what I did in Bash, create a function, a Bash function, called it menu. Paren at the end of menu means that it's a function. Put a brace, put braces in a block. And I'm just going to echo the choices that I put up on the screen. So now I run the function that I just created called menu. It's going to execute that, print this out, and then it's going to go right to here. While read-p, enter an option, colon, bracket, one, dash, five, bracket, space, quote, and then A. So what this does is while has the argument of the read part. So the read program is what I'm running right now. Before I do my do. You remember from a couple months ago, or last month, I don't remember which, what read does is it captures stuff from the prompt. So you type stuff in, basically. And if you give it a dash P option, that's the prompt that will be prompted to the user. So enter an option 135 space, and then A, in this case, is the variable that I am putting what I respond to in. So whenever I type 1, it puts it into the variable A.
Right? Wait.
Sir?
Sorry, is read putting that into A, or is while putting that into A?
Read is putting that into A because while just expects a command, or a series of commands, or a compound command, or something. Right? Like a list of commands, or something like that. So, read's putting it into A. So what you see here from before, got that. Menu prints me this, 1 through 5, you know, that sort of thing. And then I got the while and read, enter an option there, printed right there. And then I typed 5. So 5 is now put into the variable A, right? Now it does the do. Since read returns true, because I actually typed something in, it's going to do the do while, the do done loop, which is this big outer loop. Okay? I just echoed a new line, and then here we've got a new compound statement, the case. Case is similar to C-like programs' switch statement, if you're familiar with that. So what case is, the form of case is case, variable, I apologize for my handwriting. All right, so case variable, doesn't have to be a variable, but you're probably gonna want a variable. You could put a constant there, but what would be the point in having it? In a list of things, and then, what is it? I can never remember this. And then something, right for in, statements, until you get a semicolon, semicolon, and then you can have another whatever, right paren, more statements, semicolon, semicolon, and then that'll be, case needs a, yeah, that's it, that's right. And then it keeps going, you can have as many whatever's right paren until you have an ESAC, which is case spelled backwards, going back to if, v, case ESAC, all right? So this is the block, all right? So that's just the form of it. Now, the way case works is it inspects what the variable is. Oh, let me say another. No, okay, I got it wrong. I'm sorry, the in part, these are the in parts. After in is where you put the, what you're wanting to test for. And then you put, so. I'm very eloquent tonight, as you can tell. I don't know why that is, but so checks the variable. So in this case, case $A, it'll check the variable A for whatever's in it, and whatever it finds it to be, whatever it answers to be, it'll jump to that right side print statement. Okay, does that make sense to everybody? So whenever I type one for check email, it goes to this line right here. One right print. It'll echo mutt. So you saw whenever I did the check email, it typed the word mutt on the screen. It didn't actually execute it, but it, you know, told me what it was going to do. Because if I actually did this, then this would be a much longer presentation. And when I typed the number two to surf the web, it went here. And you see I've got two vertical line FF. Now, what does that mean? So this next option right here can take either a 2 or an FF as my answer to enter an option. So whenever I run this program again, I could type FF and it runs Firefox. If I type 2, it runs Firefox, right? So it did, in both cases, A resulted to be, in the first case, A resulted to be FF. So it jumped right here. In the next case, it resulted to be 2. So it did the same thing, jumped to the same place. So you can have multiple values for a certain little subblock. Okay? Then I've also got 1. If I were to type the word 1 instead of the number 1, it would do a different email program, my Gmail, let's say, for example. So if I type the word 1, Gmail comes up. So when I type the numeral 1, it ran MUT. When I type the word 1, it ran Gmail. So that's a hidden option because I didn't print it out, right? Excuse me. All right. So I need it back on the screen for me. Okay, now I've got 1, and I've explained what 2 and FF are. You see, you probably good form would say you want to have them quoted. And here again, it's a string match. It's not a numeral match. It's a string match. So it's matching the string 3, or it's matching the string character 4, the string that's non-interpreted 4. If I were to type a V, it would have executed or printed out the word Vim, because that's my editor. And you know, for a first-time user, I'm going to tell them to use OpenOffice. For me, I'm going to use Vim. Then I've also got, okay, so let me do the next option here. And you know, I didn't indent it right, but that's because my editor at work, it replaces tab characters with four spaces. So I tabbed out and got spaces instead of tab characters like the first time I edited it for some reason. So anyway, so right here I've got some strangeness here. This is using the normal wildcard blobbing. I'm going to call it both because some people know one way. Some people know it as globbing, some people know it as wildcarding. It's technically globbing, but it's wildcarding. Does anyone not know what wildcarding or globbing is? Add on the command line.
What is globbing?
Globbing is what it used to be called, and it's still called. It's just the name of it. It's a glob. So it's going to do J star or J star, capital J star, or star rock star, or 4 question marks. So if at the command line I type, you know, Jace rocks, hey, yes, Jace rocks, but anyway, so I did what this little subblock, whenever I typed Jace rocks, because it matched J star, right? It will also match the capital J, whatever. Yes, just rocks. But anyway, okay, so that's what that one said. Then let's say Mozilla rocks hard. All right. Yes, Jace rocks. But anyway, so that's the response that I get. And that's because of the glob. I got star rocks star. Okay. Is this making sense to anybody? So you jump to here because whenever I typed in Mozilla rocks hard, that matches the star rocks star, right? Does that make sense? That's in globbing and wildcarding, the star is any number of characters of any sort. The now if I do four random characters, That's what matches the question mark. Question mark means one character. So I've got four question marks up there. That's where this matches. This HJKL matches four question marks, right? So any four-letter word would match. So you take rocks. But anyway, so, all right, and then the last option, next to the last option I've got, well, I'll go to the last option because you probably, from good form, you're going to want to have your default. Go ahead.
Is there any character that either the star or the question mark doesn't match?
In this particular case, no, because it's going to put the whole thing into A as a string in single or double quotes, however you want to think about it. It's the whole string of something. So in that case, it's going to match spaces, it's going to match new lines, it's going to match, well, it won't match new lines because read. It puts it into A at the new line, a character return. So, but if I put some sort of strange option that doesn't exist up there,
it begins with a J.
It starts with a J. Yeah, okay, there we go, dry, dry. How about that? All right, huh, that's cool. Okay, so I just, anyway, dry, dry matches star, which is anything, right? Star is anything. It's similar in concept to the C-like programming language's default for the switch state. So a good form says that at the very end of your case statement, you want to have a default, because if someone types the wrong thing, you want it to do something. Whether it's report an error, no, that's not right, and runs to beat you again, or whatever. So in my case, I'm just going to exit, and exit kills the program altogether. So it comes, jumps out at any of those. Now here I've got a single quoted star, right? And what that'll do is it'll echo the word exit. So if I run this program again, and I type the character star, it's gonna go to that case. All right, is that too complex? Does that make sense? Which is different than whatever. Okay, just something to be aware of. You're not going to see it in most places, but just be aware of it. All right, any questions on this program? Everybody understand the case now? I don't want that. Anybody have any questions? Cricket. Okay. Oh, so at the end of the case statement, then I do a new line, and then I rerun the menu, go back to the read prompt, and then check, so, right? Does that make sense, the loop, the outer loop? Okay, so I did the same thing, or similar thing, with menu two, while menu two. I've got these six options, Mutt, Gmail, Firefox, OpenOffice, Vim, and Exit. So if I type that, a number to the corresponding program, 3 for Firefox, let's say, it's executing Firefox, right? And then let's say Mutt, number one, Gmail for number two, whatever. And for Vim, I'll need to do a spreadsheet and open office. Okay, so that's enough of that. Let's exit. Okay? So this is a similar idea to the menu program I just did, but a little different. So what I did here was use the select compound statement. So I've got here, I'm going ahead of myself. Similar program using select. Okay. So PS3, I'll explain that in a second. Alright, so but this time instead of using a while true, I decided to use the until compound statement. Until is almost exactly the same as while, with the exception that it's backwards. So until will keep running until the so the form of until is until commands do done, do block done, right? Until is waiting for the return value to be zero before it goes to quiz. That doesn't make sense. Okay, so while this is true, do blah, 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 blah. On the converse, until this is true, blah, 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 blah. Okay? So whereas I would have written this with a while true, this time I did it until not true. I could have said until false, but the exclamation point, that's why I did this, exclamation point on the command line before command indicates not of that, the opposite. It returns any exit value that is zero gets returned as one. Any non-zero return value gets becomes zero when you put the exclamation point in front of it, i.e. not. Any questions on that? No? Okay, so I've got an until loop. And here's my new done block. So I've got the select program. Here's the other compound statement that we're talking about tonight. Select and a variable in a list do block done. Okay, pretty simple. And you can use this variable inside here. You want to be sure you use the dollar sign variable. This, you don't want to have the dollar sign in front of it. If you exclude the in list, it assumes dollar sign one, dollar sign two, dollar sign three, blah, blah, blah. The command arguments that you get to that program. Does that make sense? Or that function. Any questions on that? Okay. So what select will do, as you saw, I've got a list of, so in my program I've got select progi, or progi, my program name, there's some variable called progi, in, and then I've got a list, mutt, gmail, firefox, openoffice, vim, exit. Just a list of words, just a space, a limited set of words. And then, so what select does, as you remember up here, is it formatted it really nicely and said the first item, number one paren, is that. So in this case, one paren what? Then it went down, and then the second one, two paren Gmail, three paren Firefox, four paren OpenOffice, five then, six exit, right? Right, does that make sense? It select just does that for you. It's just beautiful. Now when you type in a number, okay, here's the reason I've got the PS3. On the shell, you've got your PS stands for prompt. Help me out, somebody, anybody. CPS, I don't know what PS stands for, but it's your prompts. Your PS1,
prompt. PlayStation 3.
Prompt sign.
Prompt sign. I think that's what it is, prompt sign.
Yes.
Yes.
You can think of it as prompt sign, even if it's not. So right here, you see my prompt. Before I did my cat and before I ran the program earlier, I've got /usertop:\frywall_space. That is my prompt on my computer. So PS1 is defined to be user, which is, it's user@postname:\directory_space. That's my prompt. Can I show you that? If I echo PS1, no, not that one, PS1. You see here I've got /u, username, which is user1, /h, postname:\u, W, working directory, I think, > space. That's just, PS1 is your prompt at the command line. You've got PS2, which will prompt you for continuation. So if I did an echo, quote, something, no, let's see. Anyways, for continuation. And then PS3 is another one. PS3 is used specifically by select. So this is the prompt that select will give you. So you saw up here, whenever I typed in, or whenever I ran the program, select formatted this mutt, Gmail, Firefox, OpenOffice, Vim, exit into this nice little 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, and then type in a number, :, was PS3. All right, does that make sense there, bud? Just one of the things you have to set up before you use select is you have to set PS3. And of course, in your do, done, let loop, you can change it however you want to. Select will also, if you don't give it one of the option sets there, it will, like if I just hit enter, it's going to say, it'll re-display it until you type something in that it likes. So I type a 9. Nothing got assigned. So the 9th item, which doesn't exist, yeah, I've only got 6. The 9th item, which is over here somewhere, got put into Froggy, and then that Froggy part. This is where I probably would have used a case like that. But this time I decided to choose to use the true. The test program, and test for Froggy. If Froggy is the word exit, then exit. And then I'm execute, if otherwise, because exit will kill the program, otherwise it's going to echo executing, and then what the value of Froggy, dot, dot, dot. I could have run the actual program. Now you need a break after whatever, because otherwise select will just keep spinning. Just prompt the person for type one of these numbers. Even if you type in the right number, yeah, the one you want, it's just going to keep asking until you break out of the select. Okay? Select makes sense, everybody? What's up?
Can I talk now?
All right, we got more.
No!
Well, we started late. All right, I'll sit back down. This is the final batch shell scripting, so I was going to run a little over anyway.
Okay.
Do you want to go ahead and give announcements now or something?
No, I'll wait until you're done.
You sure?
Yeah.
Okay. I just got one more anyway.
I got a question on this last one.
Go ahead.
If select creates a loop, why do you have an until loop around it?
When I say select does a loop, I mean it will re-ask until you give it an answer that it can understand.
Right.
So if I type JK, well, I don't know, I've only used select just a little bit, but whenever I ran this program before and I just had the select, it wasn't working, it wasn't looping, it wasn't going back and ask. That's what it is.
It asks you one time.
It in order for it to ask again and prompt you, it will prompt you until you give it the right answer or something like that. But in order for me to run this program over and over and over and over again, I had to have the outer while loop. So if you have a select, it'll just put the menu up and do it. All right, and that's where I would have used used a case or something like that and run the program, and then continue on down the program or whatever. So I'm wanting to do this over and over again. Infinitely. Does that make more sense? Oh, and that's another thing I meant to tell you. Select, it's different from the other program in that instead of putting into this variable what I typed in, it puts into this variable what is in this list. So when I typed in 2, it put the string Gmail into Froggy, right? It didn't put a 2 in Froggy, it put the string that 2 represents, right? All right, so that's another major difference you need to understand about that. So if I do my case statements, I want to put cases around Mutt, Gmail, Firefox, not 1, 2, 3, 4, like I did before. All right? So, now what's the last one? Read stats. Okay. Should I run the program first? All right, so here I've got a little file called stats. And it's just a file I created with some random numbers. Number space number, number space number, number space number. Just like that. Some sort of statistic that I've got whenever whatever. So when I run the while read stats program, here's my output. It takes the first number, prints it, puts it X, second number, and then does product number 2. So these are the products. 2 times 78 is 156. 2 times 98,000 is 196,000. So that's my products. Then I've got my remainders. 23 mod 878, which is that one. 23 mod 878, 23. 243 mod 3 is 0. So that's this one, right? Then we've got this error right here. But I'll explain that later. Pay no attention to the man behind the curtain, right? All right, so in this program, I've got two while loops. The reason I wanted to show you this program is that you'll see a lot of this, this sort of thing. What I'm doing, first of all, is I've got I showed you the stats file, right? I'm redirecting the stats, redirecting the stats program into the sort program, sorted numerically, which is what the dash in does. So it sorts this file numerically. So all the ones will be first, the twos will be second, the threes will be third, the 23s, then the 243s, then the four yards, right? Does that make sense? That's numerically. Otherwise, if I didn't give it the dash in, you would do it alphanumerically by character. So you would see 2, 20, and then we'll go to 3, 30, 40, that sort of thing. So I do a sort of stats and pipe it into the while read AD. So read takes A and B as its variables. So what it's going to do is it's going to take the sorted stat list, and the first stat is put into A, the second is put into B, right? Then I've got this do done loop. Echo dollar sign A, X dollar sign B equals dollar sign square bracket A star B. So it's doing the multiplication substitution. A times B is the product of A and B. It prints out 2 times 1 equals 2, for example. And then it keeps looping until read returns false, which is at the end of the file. So as long as there's standard input being put into read, it's going to continue. It's going to read it, print out something. So you see up here, I've got the product 2 times 1 equals 2, 2 times 7. All right, does that make sense to everybody? Pretty simple, right? Then I've got my remainders. So I'm redirecting. This time I'm redirecting directly into read. While read, C, and D do echo dollar sign C mod, the word mod, dollar sign D equals, and then I got the dollar sign square bracket again, C percent D, which is the modulus operation, C modulus D. So right here we've got, and this time and then I've got the done, the less than, and then stats. So this time you've got stats being redirected into done, which really gets redirected into the do while. So it gets sort of put to read, right? So read, so the stats file gets opened up, sent as the standard in to the read program, and then each one gets A, you know, gets put into C and D. Does that make sense? Any questions on any of that? No? And then you see right here, division by zero error. Well, that makes sense. Somewhere in here I've got a zero error. 342 mod 0 doesn't make sense because you've got to divide by 0. You've got a black hole, right? So that's where it chokes, and the program just dies right on this line and doesn't process the rest of it. Something you need to be aware of. I would get the same thing if I would have done instead of a modulus of divide by the forward slash. Any questions on anything? This is the final Bash shell scripting session. Any questions?
Is there a way to do like error handling or something, like the mod 0?
Yeah, what I would want to do ahead of time is to check if B is is 0. Yeah. Actually, I would probably just do dollar sign B, ampersand, ampersand. Right? No? No, I'd do it
today.
No, I would do an if. If test 0 equals D, or the other way around if you want to, then do the echo part.
When you say error handling?
Else you can't divide by 0.
Or
response.
When you say error handling, are you saying handle something when an error does occur or catching an error before it occurs?
I guess it's two ways of thinking about it.
Because if you want to catch the error after it occurs, you could just test dollar question, and that'll give you the return code of the last thing executed.
What?
Dollar question mark will give you the return code of the last statement executed.
That was another thing I wanted to point out. Yes, thank you for saying that, because if I run this program again, and then I echo, see, I got a divide by zero error. If I do an echo of dollar sign question mark, one, which means false, right? So the return value of my last program was false, and that's because I got a divide by zero error. Now, if I run this again, I get a zero. Anybody know why?
It's echo.
Because echo
correctly.
Was good. It really did work, you know, echo returned fine. So the dollar sign question mark is the return value of the last thing that happened. Now, if you've got a block, you've got whatever, it's going to be the last block. So if I were to check dollar sign zero, it's the result of the read. If I did a dollar sign right up here before the done, it would have been the return by echo, right? Or which would have been the one. Then it gets passed up to the calling function and to the calling program, and that's where our error is. Okay, does that make sense? No more shell scripting for newbies.
Shell scripting for intermediate users now?
No, I'm done for a little bit.
All right, there are a number of faces I don't recognize. How about we go around the room and introduce ourselves? I'll start. My name is David Daly. I'm the person who kicks the speakers off and interrupts them. And I have a couple other announcements, but we'll move on to Jerry.
No, go ahead.
I'm done. Go ahead. All right. Introduce yourself.
Oh, you're talking about introductions, not presentations.
Yeah.
Gotcha. Jared Sutton, I'm a network engineer at The Worthwhile Company. I do web hosting and design.
David Yates. that's who I am. My name.
David what?
Yates.
You might know him from the Law of Linux Links podcast.
Or not.
I don't know. He's got a long list.
What's your real job, Dave?
I'm a... vitamin formulator. A real job, though, Jay?
Yes.
Yeah, I formulate vitamins.
Isn't that awesome?
Hardly.
He has a podcast, guys.
He's got, I think the last one that I heard figures on was 6,000 people listening.
Close.
To me, that's very impressive.
It's awesome.
What's more impressive is that he lives like 5 miles from my house, and I didn't realize it until about 3 or 4 months ago. Anyway, go ahead, John. We'll quit picking
on Dave.
Please.
Hi, I'm John Urey. I work for AGFA Healthcare. I'm the senior enterprise architect there. I design internal business systems, primarily in Java, and I'm the president of the local Java users group.
Yes, sir. I'm Glenn Peterson, and I write code for a small software company.
Jeremy Sands, I'm Director of IT Operations at Plating Group in downtown Spartanburg, CS Senior U.S. Real Estate, co-host of Sourcecast Podcast, and I'm the Director of Awesome.
Oh, man. I wondered when that was.
You're the one.
Very good.
Wes Yates, engineer in the sales department with Rearick and Computer. Everyone wants to know if I came over at the IT, I did that.
Bob Larson, I'm basically the IT department at a law firm.
I'm Carl Gerreiser, longtime lurker. I actually used to work in this building with the equipment corporation.
Really?
And this is my hobby. Because that makes me the oddest up here. I'm a personal consultant for this production. I'm a consultant.
Richard Banks, Products and Service Division, doing this, learning it.
Brenda Banks, grandmother. I'm not happy. I'm wondering how I ended up here.
Stirrer of trouble.
Yeah.
I've been good tonight.
Tonight, John.
My name's Mike Major. I work at Bosch in Anderson. I'm an engineer down there. I'm a manufacturing engineer type. Just do Linux for fun and because it's cool.
My name's Alfred Sines. I'm the Solaris admin and customer support type person.
Kevin Jones, voice data analyst at Tetra Data. Linux hobbyist.
Grant Zim, I'm currently unemployed at the moment. I used to work at the airport for a major airline. I was doing restructuring. And I've been, used to be in Windows for quite a long time, and now starting to learn Linux. It's, I'm seeing it more and more cropping up in some of the equipment I'm buying. So, now I'm not going to learn it.
Go ahead. Stuart Billings, I work on a neutered security team at Intel.
On the what?
Neutered security team.
What about you, Sam?
Neutered.
Yeah. Yeah, I kind of missed that at first, too. I was like, did you just say that?
Who was this at?
Intel.
It's a cell. The one for Intel.
So, what's your bad block?
What's neutered security? That means we don't do security, it means we actually do identity maintenance. But we call us a security team. So.
Ah. We are being recorded, so.
Ankos, that block is.
Ankos, right?
Go ahead.
I'm Norm Morgan. I live at Bulwark, and I just started learning Linux about a year ago after I just got sick of Windows.
Amen.
And I will not spill your thunder tonight.
Pam Nally, caretaker of David Nally. Yeah,
that's the toughest job.
President of Nally's Darn, St. John's Rescue, and director of a remote hospital.
Thank you.
Speaking of neuter.
And I use Linux. Put a gun to my head. I'm just kidding.
And I'm Jace. I'm Jace Ecker. I did the Bash shell scripting thing. I'm a Linux programmer at Condry Corporation. We are the guys that actually write Novell Storage Manager. Novell reseller stuff.
What's your name again, Jace?
Jace.
What does everyone call you?
Call me Jace. Sometimes it gets a laugh, actually.
It gets a laugh when you actually do it, and we don't have to
call. Okay. Hi, my name is Jace. I go by
Jace.
Is that short for something?
It's short for just something.
Just another something.
What?
A GLA.
All right.
I've got a couple of announcements. Direct that. Jared Luce. A couple of things happened.
Jared, you didn't know you were employed, did you?
I'm sorry?
What's your name? My name is David Nowen. I'm the person who interrupts people. Southeast Linux Fest. We have a date, which we didn't have last month. We have a venue, which we didn't have last month. And we have a board, which we didn't have last month. And there's a ton of work to do. Anybody wants to do work? Anybody wants to be the secretary?
Sorry, you're
that position
permanently
could be open.
Founded.
But we meet Tuesday nights, 9 o'clock, in Ash Southeast Linux Fest on irc.freenode.net. If you need help getting on to IRC, someone around here can help you. The date is June 13th, and it's going to be at Clemson. And we're going to need lots and lots of help, particularly from people in the upstate who live near here.
In the form of
nine.
We're going to need people who can
who can man the registration booth. We're going to need people who can operate
people that help vendors who are coming.
People that help vendors, show them where they're going, help them move stuff in, because we've got at the moment a very short setup window. We've got a number of things going. I think we approved the event's going to be free, with an option that you pay $50 and you'll be declared a supporter of SELF, and we'll give you a t-shirt and we might invite you to a party.
If you're cool enough.
Yeah, there is some minimum requirement there.
We have to count all of us in the room out.
And that's cool with us by us. And we may have some LUG incentive here, which essentially says that if you'll help us, we might incentivize that. But that has not yet been decided on, so that's my thought and not the board's.
Go ahead.
We are talking to Clemson about sponsoring some costs for us. Clemson's LUG is actually sponsoring the location, and they're eating about $2,000 of costs that we would have otherwise paid, and anywhere else it would have cost us $4,000-$6,000 just to get the venue. So for our first year, we're going to put up with something that's probably not ideal from an exposition standpoint, but is a can handle good number of people. Before I get into the website, Software Freedom Day, September 20th. Kevin's running that. I handed off some swag to him. That's going to be at the library. So come help some people install Linux, get used to Linux.
Is that the downtown?
That is downtown, one we were at last year. It is downtown library. And so anyone who's listening to Dave Yates' podcast, that's near Greenville, September 20th. I believe you're starting at 10 o'clock?
Yeah,
10 a.m.
Till 3 p.m.
Till 3 p.m. If you want news, what's your email address?
freelinuxpc@gmail.com.
And so you just heard his email address, and I'm sure that Dave Yates will put something in his show notes to point to the poster.
Do we have show notes?
There are show notes every episode.
Is there?
Yes.
Wait. The script's in there.
Yeah. Jeremy.
Can we put some directions to this place on the website whenever you are with us?
Let's not get on the website yet, but we'll talk about that. Charleston is having a Linux demonstration day, free software demonstration day, September the 14th at the Muddy Waters Coffee Shop. That is, I think it's 10 to 4 or something like that. I may be wrong about the times. You can see it at csclug.org, so if you're in the Charleston area, you should go to that. And a couple of us are going to go down and try and bend their ears. The website. Medion gave us a virtual machine on their VMware cluster, and we're thankful, and they're giving it to us gratis. Technically, I'm on the hook for the site, so I'm happy to grant pseudo access given the following requirements being met. That you provide me with a mobile phone number that I can send text messages to, because you'll be on Nagios alerts if you have pseudo access. An email address. That you convince me that you're at least somewhat competent to operate Linux. Or that you can fool me. If you can fool me, that works too.
I am in.
Firstborn child?
Don't care about children. I don't want any children. They're a lot of responsibility. My wife would complain at having another child. Let's put it that way.
You don't want more children.
Right.
Oh, yeah. So that's different.
I am the child right now. I don't need competition. So anyway, the Medion's going to do it, and whoever picks up and runs with whatever they want can can do whatever they want as far as platform, database, et cetera. But we need to make a mention that the media gave it to us and publicly provide a link. And did I say that you got to be willing to accept my text messages and emails from Nagus?
Yes.
And the website goes down. So those are the only requirements. That's pretty easy to pull off. And so what we're going to do now is, if you want to have pseudo access, go ahead.
Don't we have a new address too? It's not UCLub.org anymore.
It will be, hopefully tonight. Give you a brief history. Our website went down a couple months ago. Bob used to work at a service provider and consulting place, and the box went down, and I don't know the details of it, but having something that only one person can get to is a bad idea. So we're going to try and eliminate some of that single point of failure by having multiple people who essentially have root level access, and then making them responsible so that they can start getting annoyed at 3 o'clock in the morning. And they've got dual or triple redundant feeds here, so we should have a bandwidth or connection issue here. So if you want that level of responsibility, you can come see me and I'll get you that level of access. And we're going to let Jared talk, and hopefully we can hack out at least the beginnings of a site by the time the meeting's over, or 9 o'clock, whichever comes first. And after Jared's done, I'll tell you the 2-minute way to set up a kiosk with SE Linux.
All right. As I said before, my name is Jared Sutton. I work for the Worthwhile Company. There was some discussion on the list this past week about what exactly a kiosk is. And at least from my standpoint, there's multiple definitions, and it really depends on whether you're talking about an interactive kiosk or just something that displays information. And I've worked with both at different jobs and things that I was doing. And this past week, my boss asked me to design a kiosk type setup that basically just displays a presentation in our lobby area on a big LCD screen. And so I decided to go with a thin install just on a really compact shuttle machine that we built for pretty cheap. And I really decided there was no use spending, you know, however much, 40, 50 bucks on a hard drive when we've got a VM server with plenty of disk space, and it would be really cool if you could just boot right over the network into some OS that's stored somewhere else on the network. And so I started searching around, and at first I was thinking just do a plain Pixie boot with NFS, which I had done with something else before. And then I came across this project called GPixie, and I'm not sure if you guys are aware of what Pixie is. Basically, it's just a boot ROM that you're basically grabbing information from your DHCP server and using that information to bootstrap something on your machine. And Pixie is very limited by itself. I believe it was written by Intel originally. I could be wrong on that, but I see their name all over, copyrights all over it. So, but it's very limited as to what it can do. It can basically grab something from a TFTP server and shove it into memory. That's about all that I know of that it can do. The great thing about it is that GPixie is basically something that you can bootstrap from Pixie. And so you can shove it on shove your GPixie image onto a TFTP server. And then that gives you a more expanded set of options as to what you can boot off of your network. And it can connect to HTTP, FTP, TFTP, and the big ones here that I'm focused on are ATA over Ethernet, AOE, and iSCSI. And iSCSI is the thing I'm really using. I experimented a little with AOE, but it was not something I really could get my head around. But really, iSCSI, any of you that into server administration, might be aware of iSCSI, and it basically presents some disk. It could be either a disk image or a physical disk or partition or whatever you want. It presents that as a SCSI device to the machine that's connecting to the iSCSI server. And so you can connect to the iSCSI server and say, I want to use that disk. And all of a sudden, on your Linux box or Windows box, if you want to use Windows, it shows up as another SCSI device in your system. It's pretty transparent to the user land. And so you can run fdisk and you can, you know, repartition the disk or do whatever you want. It really looks like a physical disk. And what gpixie allows you to do, you're bootstrapping from Pixie into gpixie, and then you can connect to an iSCSI server using gpixie and boot right off of it. So what I did here was I set up on our physical network at work, I set up our DHCP server. We're using DNS mask. I don't know if you guys have heard of that. It's a combination DHCP, DNS, and TFTP server. And I set that up to basically just hand out the information for bootstrapping the gpixie ROM image to the clients. And so it boots gpixie. And it also passes a little parameter telling it where to find the iSCSI disk that it's going to boot. And give me just 1 second here, I can pull up that config file. VM that I'm running here, and it's got a basic Kubuntu install with basically everything turned off, and DNS mask installed and configured here. Basically, it's just it's listening on this address right here, and it's passing it's listening on the H0 interface. It's passing some DHCP options, and this defines what range it's going to hand out IP addresses with, and I'm turning on the TFTP server, as you notice there, and telling it where to find the TFTP root directory. And the DHCP match there is basically, it's saying it's going to pass. That's actually an option that your Pixie client is going to pass back if it tries to boot again. If gpixie, for some reason, were to time out, it exits the gpixie ROM and then tries to keep on Pixie booting something, and so it goes back to the server and says, hey, I need something. And this is going to keep it from getting gpixie again and just, you know, looping around, loop, 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 loop. And so it sends this guy to the Pixie client, and that's going to send it back to the server whenever it tries to boot again. And this line here is saying, if it's not that option, then send it this image. And this is the parameter that it's sending. It's telling it what iSCSI disk to use. All right. And that's pretty much all that's on the DHCP and DNS and TFTP side. That's all DNS mask. It's pretty small. You can run it on your WRT router if you really want to. All right. And as far as iSCSI is concerned, let me pull that up real quick. Here to the iSCSI configuration. You just define your target name. They have some weird conventions as to what you're supposed to call the iSCSI targets, and I pulled something and modify it out of a how-to. I really don't think it really matters. You can name it anything you want, but just for the sake of saving face, I made it something that looks somewhat cryptic and official. You basically specify your target name and then tell it here, this is just a plain old virtual disk that I attached to the VM, and I'm telling it, it's just going to access it like a regular block device and pass it right over the network. And that's all there is to the ISCSI configuration. On that image now, I end up, I mount it on my system, and I use Dev Bootstrap to do a basic Ubuntu Hardy install on the disk image, and then install Grub and all sorts of wonderful things to make it bootable. All right. And that's all there was to that. And then the last thing was simply, I've created another VM that has, no disks at all attached to it. And all it has is the first boot device is the network interface that I have. And it's pointing, as you can see here, you picked up the, here, let me reset that real quick just so you can see. As you can see, it's grabbing an IP address from the DHCP server right here. And it's trying to grab an IP address from the DHCP server. You can do it! All right, we're just going to try powering off real quick on this and turn it back on. There we go. And as you can see, it loaded GPixie right here. And it loaded the ISCSI target, and it's booting Grub right now. And at this point, it's basically grabbing the initial RAM disk. It's accessing it just like it was a local hard disk. And there was just a little bit of finagling with having the kernel load the kernel has to load the ISCSI driver too so that it can actually see the disk. And
so did you have to recompile the kernel?
No. The only thing I had to do was modify a few files with the init RAMFS configuration and then regenerate my initial RAM disk. And there's actually some how-tos out there on that. Now this is actually the same image that I'm using at my workplace. I just DD'd a copy off of it. And it runs a little promotional video that one of our marketing people made up. And that's Cody Webster, our mascot, like that. So anyway, so that's just about all there is to it. And I know that really was a lot of steps, but it's actually not that hard. I think I set this up in about an hour and a half, and most of that was fighting with VirtualBox's internal networking that tends to not work at some times and work other times. But as far as getting it to work on the physical network, it worked almost instantaneously once I understood the concepts. And there were some changes that I had to hack out some of the scripts that you had to throw into the initial RAM disk to make it work right. And the scripts that they had on one of the how-tos I was following was completely screwed up, and I had to hack them together myself. So I'm probably going to just go ahead and write another how-to and post it out there, just for anyone else that happens to want to do the same thing. And really, the point is that you can have with enough existing network infrastructure, you can have a thin client installation out there with just some disk image on a server somewhere running open ISCSI, which is free. And you can have a motherboard, CPU, and probably just integrated video on the motherboard. That's all our box has, just an Intel chipset. And you can have a thin client installed right there that you just plug in and go. No hard drive, no optical drive, nothing. And that's all I got.
Are you using the new version of VirtualBox?
Yes. I just pulled that last night, in fact. That's probably why I was having so many problems.
All right. I went searching the net because I've seen a nice how-to on how to use SE Linux to do a kiosk. And by kiosk, I mean something that's going to wipe every single time that you do something. So think public internet cafe that allows you to come use a computer for a specified amount of time. Or one of the community centers that the Free Linux PC project is thinking about setting up for places like Seniors Unlimited. You have these people who are in their 60s and 70s going, sitting down in the machine, the last thing you want to do is have them try and go to their bank account and it opens someone else's account, or try and go to Gmail and it opens someone else's email. And that's rife with all kinds of privacy concerns. So what you're looking for is you're looking for a desktop, maybe even a limited desktop, that you can allow people to log into that cleans itself up, because you're not going to want to create a user for every single person in an internet cafe or in a community center. They may be there one time or they may be there all the time. So I found the document that had about 20 or 30 steps on how to configure SE Linux to essentially wipe the all of that data as soon as the person logged out there, and to limit what they could do pretty severely. And then I realized that, oh yeah, this person thought it was such a good idea, they made a package out of it. So the way that you set this up, if you're using CentOS, Rail, or Fedora, is yum install xguest. And you do have to have SE Linux set to enforcing. It can't be permissive or disabled because it won't allow you to log in then. But then it comes up on the, when GDM comes up, it comes up with a option for guest. You click on guest, it logs you in without a password, gives you access to a predefined set of programs, which you can modify the security, the SE Linux model and policy to change what they have access to. But the default is to essentially give them what any unprivileged user would have. They can go in, they can create Word files, they can write them to Flash, they can write them to the temp file system if they want, but it goes away. They can surf the web just like any other user could, as long as they don't need root level access, it'll do anything they want. It does not allow them to shell in. It only allows connections via GDM. And it's 34K SE Linux policy. So I was going to get up here and say, there are these 20 steps and get through them, but as long as you don't mind using a Red Hat-ish based operating system, you can have a console, a kiosk set up with single command. And that's it. And that made it very easy on me.
All right, so what is it, how do you determine what is not, what programs they can and cannot use?
You would use security labels. So you would allow people with xguest to execute things like Firefox, but not allow them to execute other things.
Is that SE Linux thing?
Yeah, file labels.
It's what?
File labels.
File labels.
Yeah, or it's also called contexts. Now you would probably also want to do you probably also want to configure what menu they see. But they're seeing essentially whatever in Etsy skeleton. So however you configure that is what they're going to see each time it loads.
What's the command? So it creates a new guest user?
No. Yes, it does create a new guest user. But the guest user can only log in via Gmail. Yum install xguest. Anything else I can answer?
Let me make sure I'm understanding. This is targeted towards using thin clients.
No, this isn't towards using thin clients. This is, for instance, Kevin's working on getting three or four computers set up at the senior center.
Okay.
They have about 15 people who are going to come in and use them. And essentially, we don't want one person seeing what the other person was doing, but we also don't want to create 15 accounts on each machine or have to deal with setting up a LDAP server or anything of that nature, because we don't want to maintain that. We want something they can go in, they can use the computer. When they leave, it's just as it was when they came in.
Can you set the permissions different for the guest users? Or
yes.
For what? This guest user can have this permission, and this one can't?
There is only one guest user because they could log in without a password. If you really wanted that level of different permissions, you'd probably create a user and then assign a new password. But this is designed to essentially wipe away anything that they do. And since you can't control who has access to it, if they get to the keyboard, there's just not a whole lot of point.
So this does not use AppArmor or anything like that?
as purely as humans. That's also mounting a temp file system. They get a like a 1D8 temp file system that just goes away.
Could you use that part?
I don't know. I don't know enough about that part.
What was the name you used besides context files?
Label. Files have an additional attribute of context or labeling, and it specifies who can access it and how they can access it.
That's not a new feature, but has it always been called that in SELinux?
It has always been called that in SELinux.
Is that a file system level attribute?
That's a
yes,
policy.
Because there's a chcon, which changes contents.
Okay.
And restoreCon, a few other. And if you do, I think it's ls-z, you'll see the context. It's either dash x or dash z. If you have SELinux turned on. If you want to see this, I set it up on my laptop in about 5 minutes.
Chelsea.
All right, I'll show you.
Please.
SELinux is a mandatory access control. Essentially, the NSA said that they did not, they were not getting fine-grained enough permissions with Unix ACLs. So they developed a layer on top of that called mandatory access controls, which in addition to what you have, what you can read, write, or execute, you also have to have a label that says you can do that. Part of the thought is that, you know, if Apache gets compromised, Apache should not be touching other files. So even if you have something running as root, if it's that process, it should never do anything except what's expected of it.
What did you say that? LS-1.
Capital Z.
I think it's Cap Z, yeah. See if I can get it to detect. I may have to change resolution. It tends to not like 1680 by 1050.
Maybe this is not my system.
Okay. Oh, it was here for a second. Oh, there it is. All right, so come in as guest. And so you get access to my 1 gig SD card to write stuff to. And so we'll go out here and we'll...
Could you send that to me like a... partition, or can you set it to be a RAM disk? Or
well, currently,
what is that?
Currently, the home directory is stored on a temp file system, which is how XGuest is set up. And but it sees anything that's plugged into the machine. So if I plug USB into it, it would see the USB drive. And right now, there's a 1 gig SD card.
Okay, so the SD card or the 1 gig is not the
right. No, it just happened to be in the machine, and just like you would have somebody tell them to write to flash drive or something like that.
Would it see a mounted file system?
What'd you say?
Would it see a mounted file system? I mean, like a remote share or something if it were mounted?
If the user had rights to do that, but I don't think the user does unless it's something like FTP. Or maybe SFTP. So you can write stuff to flash or SD or whatever, whatever it's going to mount without needing root level permissions.
Floppy.
I don't know. Do floppies auto mount? So let's come over here and we will create something on the desktop. Office. By the way, I'm running an encrypted, fully encrypted disk, so everything takes forever on my tiny little 2.5-inch drive.
Encrypted?
Well, except for B, site B is not encrypted, but swap and everything else is.
Where's the key?
In my head.
Oh, okay. I thought maybe you kept it on the SD card or something.
No, I can add like 15 different keys, and I could do that, but I don't. All right, so we saved open office document there. If we log out, come back in just by clicking.
Take your word for it.
Well, it'll work. It'll come up in a second. It comes up with nothing there except for what's in skeleton profile. And that's not bad for setting up a kiosk in just a few seconds.
How do you restrict which applications they have access to?
You would. That's a little more intensive. You'd have to change the, you do one of two things. You'd either hide the files from them, which isn't really restricting, by changing what they see in the skeleton profile, or you would, you change the context in SC Linux so that they could not execute this file, or both.
Can you share that real quick, or is it more involved?
Let's see if I can. That's my console. What is terminal? I'm not a GNOME user, but no, actually, right now they have access to anything that a non-privileged user would have access to. What am I missing here? Is it all under GNOME? Skeleton profile for new users. Where can new users draw there?
Usually they just copy it. Whatever's in the central scale into the home directory.
Yeah. Yeah. That's it?
That's it. Yeah, because there's your .NET is going to have all your profile stuff in it.
But,
at least for
them. Yeah, but I see nothing there.
Well, it could be pulling up defaults then.
Yeah, it may be. You might have to define that out.
Could be wrong.
But see, we're home xguest on home xguest type. It has created a temp file system, but I don't know why it's saying type 9. But let's see, can we change that? I'm trying to cheat, I don't use the GUI much, so I don't know if it's here or not.
It's under administration.
Is it under administration?
Well, I mean, it's got the bind option there. That's like bundling in the folder. But,
yeah.
But why is it? Why would it have the same thing for both?
I don't know.
That's weird.
That is weird. If you want to read how this works, a guy named Dan Walsh wrote up a nice tutorial on how to do this before he packaged all of this into a package.
CDMA.
Yeah, you come carry your Verizon card running with you. And you might as well let Network Manager manage it for you. Walsh. Read up a very nice article, and you can put this in the show notes, Dave. danwalsh.livejournal.com, site 13376.
And let's see, what am I missing? This section here, I think, is how it's mounting TempFS on XGuest's home. Yes. But to answer your question, there are things like browser. If you want them to only run the browser, you can do things like browser confine XGuest, which is a predefined policy for where is SE Linux management? I can't run SE Linux management. But it will confine them to doing nothing but the browser. If you want them to do it for sites other than local sites, i.e. running on that particular box, you have to allow them to write data from Firefox, etc. So you can get it narrowed down pretty well. Now these have been predefined, these two booleans within SE Linux have been predefined, and make that a little easier if you just want to give them net access and not at an office or something of that nature. Anything else I can answer? All right. It is 8:13. Are we going to Indigo Joe's again?
Yes.
All right. So we need to be there before 9.